Welcome to the Frictionless Innkeeper podcast series. Our show is brought to you by the Frictionless Guest app, which allows innkeepers to provide guests with their recommendations of the best local places to eat, play, and shop during their stay. The Frictionless Guest app is accessible through all mobile and desktop devices, and you can learn more about it by visiting frictionlessguest.com. Once again, that's frictionlessguest.com. I'm Matt Langan, and I'll be joined by Steve Short, the founder and CEO of the Frictionless Guest app. And our guests for this episode are Isabel Chicoin and Kareem Houri, who are the owners of the Woodstocker B&B in Woodstock, Vermont. And Isabel and Kareem will be sharing their story about how they came to be innkeepers, their overall Airbnb strategy, and what the future holds for the Woodstocker B&B. And Isabel and Kareem and Steve, how y'all doing today?
Hi, pretty good. Thank you.
Doing well, Matt.
Well, great. Well, thank you all for joining today. And let's go ahead and kick it off and start at the top for Isabel and Kareem. If you don't mind, tell us a bit more about your backgrounds and how you all came to be innkeepers in Vermont.
Well, we came from the corporate world. I was a communications director in a private school. And prior to that, I was a lawyer in France. That's, we're talking 10, 15 years ago.
And as far as I'm concerned, I worked in financial services for the vast majority of my career, hovering between product management to risk management to project management.
That's great. And coming from both of these highly professional backgrounds, what made you want to be innkeepers?
I think it was a combination of where we were in our personal lives. We were recently married. We had both very fulfilling careers and get to a point in life when you kind of, you know, take stock and appreciate what you had and think, you know, maybe you want to change your lifestyle, have it, you know, a little more meaningful, being a little more together also. And a change of environment also. We were in jobs that required very heavy commuting. And that took a toll, and I think that sort of started the whole process of thinking about changing things.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that our first step was not to say, you know, we want to quit our jobs and become innkeepers. It happened over time. Mm-hmm. You know, as Isabel said, looking for a change. I mean, our careers were fulfilling, our colleagues were great, but, you know, leaving at 6 in the morning, coming back at 8 p.m., you know, on average commuting about an hour and a half each way. Just after a while, you sit back and you say, okay, we're also working on weekends anyway, so why don't we try to do something where we would spend a little bit more time together? And we considered the variety of businesses, so innkeeping didn't come first. At one point, we thought about, hey, how about roofing business in Colorado? That followed the trip, you know, to Colorado. We were looking at that as an option. We also looked at an internet business, you know, from home. So that was another option we looked at. And then one day we were driving out of a bed and breakfast and we kind of looked at each other and we said, well, if we're not necessarily looking to make a huge amount of money, but we want to have a lifestyle that's a little bit closer to what we're looking for, how about considering that? And then this is when the research started, right? I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about the seminar we went to.
Right. We kind of, on the back of an envelope, you know, put some numbers down and had no idea, you know, that it could work out for us. So we did some research on brokers and we found a couple of brokers who actually did some seminars for aspiring innkeepers. So we joined one of these and that kind of validated the concept. Under certain circumstances. So you needed to have the right property in the right market, the right number of rooms, but it was a valid business proposition. Again, like Kareem said, as long as you weren't looking to really get rich, you could make a living out of it.
Yeah.
So we did that.
And then we also, you know, it's not something that's very common, but there are a few innkeepers, call it the innkeeping circuit, that actually are well known for offering apprenticeship in their inns. And so we contacted one of those inns, and as long as you stay there as a paying guest, of course, you pretty much end up working for the innkeepers, end up working for the housekeepers. We did that for a long weekend. It was an invaluable eye-opener for us, frankly. And it was really an asset test also. You know, is this something we're willing to do on a day-to-day basis? Are we willing to actually roll up our sleeves and take care of housekeeping tasks should one of, you know, the housekeepers not be able to make it to work? You know, obviously we do pitch in, but in a more intensive way. And we said, yeah, I mean, this is something that we could actually do. And that led to a much more in-depth research of a viable property. And this is how we, you know, ended up finally purchasing the Woodstocker Bed and Breakfast.
Yeah, that's great. Great insights there. Appreciate that. And yeah, if you don't mind, tell us about how you searched for the properties, the process that you both went through to get to where you are today with the Woodstocker.
Well, first, actually, very early on in the process, we wanted to make sure that we weren't influencing each other and that we both have the same vision and the same idea of what our life would look like. So we designed a spreadsheet with a bunch of questions, you know, the environment, the lifestyle, the daily tasks. What do we see ourselves doing in the business? What do we see the other one doing in the business? With a bunch of questions like that. And then we just filled in that sheet blind from what the other one was filling in. And then we compared notes. We wanted to make sure, I think we had a benchmark. We needed to have 80% the same answers of overlap. Otherwise, we were not going to do this because we had a different vision. And yeah, we were, I think, pretty well above 80%. So that was the first thing where we wanted to make sure that, you know, we were both on board for the same type of vision. And I think that also opened our eyes that we both wanted to be in a mountain setting. We wanted to go skiing. So then the geographical narrowing down started. Because our first aha moment was in Colorado, we did consider Colorado for a bed and breakfast. We were also open to New York, that's where we were, and Vermont, because we just loved the state. We quickly discarded Colorado for various reasons that we, you know, uncovered. Well, first of all, there was a practical reason. We lived in the New York area, and it was not practical to go visit B&Bs over the weekend. But also looking at a couple, we had numbers, I think, from a couple of B&Bs, we realized that they weren't doing so well from what we saw. We could be wrong. And our analysis was that a bed and breakfast to attract a lot of traffic needed to be next to a highly urbanized area. And that's our analysis. Not sure how, you know, accurate it is, but we figured, you know, even if you live in Denver, you look out the window and you see the mountains. So there's not that pull to get out of the city and go to a B&B the way that it is, you know, that you might experience it if you live in the New York area or the Boston area. So then we focused on New York and Vermont. And then New York, we were thinking about the Hudson Valley in particular. They just weren't any properties for sale at that
time.
At least
not in our price range.
Not in our price range, right. And so then we focused on Vermont. And then we started working with a broker who specialized on the East Coast, but mainly New England and mainly Vermont. Mm-hmm. And we visited about 20 properties with her.
Yeah, actually, we did romanticize a little bit
at the beginning, right?
Where we like, we're seeing ourselves in this isolated, beautiful bed and breakfast somewhere out in sort of the outdoorsy, really far away in Vermont, etc. And then we quickly got a reality check. I mean, unless you are actually purchasing a property that's the destination
by itself.
Or you're going to create a destination property. Both those propositions would cost a lot of money. We quickly realized that from a financial point of view, what made more sense is to be in the quote-unquote larger towns in Vermont. Burlington, you know, not much happening there, not much for sale there. So then we narrowed our search towards the three towns, Manchester, Stowe, and then Woodstock. And then Stowe, you know, even though we liked it, we felt it was a little bit far from the metropoles, frankly. Also, the business model is a little bit different from a competitive point of view there. So at least this is what we uncovered. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of very sort of high, top-notch type of resorts there with which you would have to compete on pricing, which makes it tough when you have anywhere between, you know, 6 and 12 or 15 rooms, right? So then we also looked at Manchester. There wasn't much offering there, but whatever was there also, I mean, we liked the town itself, but it wasn't that far away from the city yet. So Woodstock was really a nice, sweet spot, actually.
What was interesting was that we had never been to Woodstock, although we had come to Vermont a lot. And so we had a discovery trip to Woodstock. We spent, I think it was Labor Day weekend there. Mm-hmm. And there were several properties for sale that were in our price range. And we wanted to have a feel for the town. So we really, you know, went into the shops and kind of, you know, wanted to see how welcoming or friendly the people were. And we really fell in love with Woodstock. We'd never been here before. I think we had stopped once, but it was super cold and we barely got out of the car and then we drove through. So that doesn't really count. But that weekend, we went to Billings Farm. Yeah. We went to several restaurants.
Actually, there was an episode of one shop owner that had moved to Woodstock, and she was sharing with us all the reasons she did it.
And the people were just so welcoming and friendly. She's an artist, and she has an art gallery. And we walked in there, and she was just so friendly. We felt that we had to share why we were here. And she immediately said, you would love it. We moved out of New York to raise our kids here, never looked back. And there are so many other people in Woodstock who have done that. I know, it was just a great experience, including finishing up the Saturday night dancing under a disco ball, which we didn't expect in Vermont. But anyway,
yeah,
it was really validated, you know, the place.
And then the point that you made, Isabel, about the fact that there were other inns for sale. It so happened that a number of innkeepers had been in that business anywhere between 10 and 15 years,
right.
And they were all more or less ready to sell at the same time. So given that we were in the market as potential buyers, we did have access to the financials, and that gave us the great comparison point and also showed us what the opportunity is from a financial point of view. So that informed the decision even more, actually.
Because at that point, we sort of fallen for a property that was sort of in the boondocks. You know, this enabled us to have a comparison point between a property that's in a market that in itself attracts people. So it doesn't market itself. I think everybody in the community of Woodstock needs to chip in and help selling Woodstock to tourists. But at least there's this whole movement. It's a magnet. A place in the middle of nowhere, like Kareem was saying, is, unless it's one of those destination places, it is not a magnet. So it's much harder to attract people. And having the numbers of these different properties for sale at the same time helped us, you know, realize that and helped us in our choice.
So the Woodstocker Bed and Breakfast caught our eye because, well, the previous owners have done a lot of the structural work, frankly. But there was enough flexibility, if you will, in the property that we could put our own brand on it without taking away a very strong previous brand, for example. I don't know if I'm explaining that well. So there was an opportunity for us to come in and make some changes without necessarily taking the risk of scaring away a client base that was already very much in love with the existing sort of look and feel of the place. So that was one piece also. And then the other piece, frankly, is the owner's quarters at the Woodstocker Bed and Breakfast are just incredible, which is something that is not always the case in a lot of those bed and breakfasts. Generally, the owner's quarters is not a priority, frankly. And at the end of the day, you know, do you want to retire in an area that's kind of dark under the roofs and things like that? Or do you want to be in a place where you can, you know, recharge for the next day? And the previous owners had done a lot of great renovation work in the owner's quarters at the Woodstocker Bed and Breakfast. So that was another very good selling point, too.
That's great. So in terms of the property itself, tell us a little bit more about it. How many rooms you have, some of the unique features, all that good stuff.
So it's an older house. It has, and there were various additions built through it. The main building is 1830, and then throughout the years, different buildings were added. It became a long structure. We have 9 bedrooms, and that includes 2 suites and a junior suite. The suites are a bedroom and separate living room, and we added saunas to one of the suites and one of the junior suites. In the junior suite, we created a space to add a sauna. And the other suite, we totally revamped the whole space to build a new suite, really. The unique features, I guess, maybe the fact that we offer a menu for breakfast. We have several items on our breakfast menu, and people choose whatever they want to eat.
We also have an option to bring you your breakfast in bed.
Yeah.
So that is an option which, you know, obviously is very common in hotels, but not necessarily that common in a bed and breakfast. We are walking distance to, you know, shops and restaurants. We also take advantage of the fact that Woodstock is almost a four-season place for tourists. Very close to Killington, 20 minutes away by car from the first gondola.
So,
hiking, there's hiking right behind the property, actually.
Yeah. So circling back to the B&B, we chose to have, and that was also a learning, something that we learned throughout the search for a bed and breakfast. We decided to turn it entirely to king beds, and it was already an adult-only property, but we really brought that a notch further by removing all the some rooms had twin beds, some rooms had queen. So we changed everything to king bed, and we really wanted to be a nice getaway for couples. But we don't really want to be like overly romantic. That's not really our look and feel. We're really more like rustic chic or super relaxed, or we wanted to bring back a look that was mountain and farmhouse and Vermont with a twist, rather than other things that were already very well done in Woodstock in the romantic type style of bed and breakfast. We really, you know, all the bed and breakfasts here have like 8 to 10 rooms pretty much. So together we're like a small hotel. Our position is that having many different bed and breakfasts is a force for a community, and we wanted to make sure that we filled a niche that was not done yet. We didn't want to copy somebody else. We thought that'd be a great mistake, because we think somebody who wants to go to Vermont, they might say, hey, let's just go to Woodstock because they have a bunch of different great bed and breakfasts, and then you can just choose whichever you want depending on the style that you like. Just like what we did for our bedroom, they're all different. So, you know, they all have that kind of guiding, you know, same kind of feel of most of them are this mountain type feel, but not all of them. But we want people to have the individual experience. That's what we were looking for.
Right. I mean, I don't want to throw the word boutique out there, but it's boutique-ish if you want to. And one of our guests actually described the place as being sophisticated, but so relaxed.
Very relaxed.
We also have a library, which actually was created by the previous owners.
Yeah.
They were in the publishing business, and people love to hang out in the library, even though I do remind them that it's not mandatory to read while you're hanging out there. That gets a little giggle from people, but yeah, that pretty much covers it.
That's great. Steve, so let me ask.
So it's interesting. It sounds like, and I think, you know, obviously from with the marketing background, I feel like, well, the differentiation is needed. That's a smart move. And so it sounds like that was the driver. But when I look at the rooms, the images on the website, and just the feel of the website as well, I get the feeling that it feels more like a millennial sort of approach. And I was wondering if that was part of it. If you consciously said, well, not only do we need to differentiate ourselves from the other places in town, but this is kind of more of the look that's going to be more appealing to the millennials as opposed to the very antique-y type of approach that a lot of bed and breakfasts have.
This is the look that we like. And
we're certainly not millennial.
Well, I don't know. We had a whole conversation with a friend about what a millennial is, and he was like, millennial is an attitude, it's not an age. And so we decided we are millennials. If you're on your phone, and because I spent my last, I mean, I'm a lot on my phone looking at whether other, you know, I love Etsy, I love, you know, I love Pinterest, I follow other places on Instagram. So to that extent, I guess it's not a generational thing, it's more of an attitude thing. But, and Dream is the one who absolutely wanted all the USB plugs everywhere. And
well, it was a convenience. I mean, you know, it's interesting that you're actually asking this, because, you know, even though we've been in business really officially since, let's call it the middle of May, beginning of June, right? By the way, we purchased the place in March, and, you know, we worked on it for a couple of months. So we tried looking at our clients' segment or segmentation, if you will, based on those few months. And we couldn't pinpoint a specific age, or we couldn't pinpoint, from what we could tell, specific socioeconomic background. It's really a nice mix. And also from a geographic point of view, I mean, we have people that come from Europe on a New England tour that like to stay with us. We've got also people coming from Australia. But I think there's a common denominator. It's people who want to get away, want to relax, and want to really feel that they're, that's going to sound a little bit home, away from home.
Right.
That sounds a little bit like a stereotype,
but
this is what people tell us, actually.
Somebody said it's like home, but better, because, you know, there's more attention to everything. It's not like we wake up in the morning and we're like, okay, let's do something that's going to appeal to millennials, right? But I think it's still a little bit that, but it's not to appeal to that segment. It's that this is how we feel about how things should be done, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know if that fully answered your question.
I don't think it is.
Yeah, maybe what we need is a little bit more time under our belt to really figure out the type of guests that likes to stay here.
Definitely.
Without necessarily putting a tag on them, but maybe trying to find that common denominator, right?
Yeah, now that makes sense. And I think, you know, what Isabel is saying about mindset as opposed to just the age group per se makes
sense.
And the reason why I thought of it actually is because we did a podcast a little while ago with a woman who her and her husband have a place up in Michigan, South Haven, and they're in their, I guess, I'm not sure, early to mid 60s, maybe, Matt, I'm guessing.
Right.
Elaine Herbert, you know.
Yep.
And so they consciously started to appeal, you know, target millennials. In fact, one of the podcasts was about that, and partly mostly because they kind of like that group, you know, the mindset of that group, actually. So they did consciously, and they shifted because they've been around for like 30 years. But, you know, part of what Elaine said, and you can see it in the website, it's more streamlined and clean, you know, in terms of just the website and trying to appeal to millennials, and as well as the decor. I mean, she said how they changed the gardens and everything. You know, they went from this more traditional looking, I forget what she said, whether it was doilies or what it was, like get rid of the doilies or something, like, and they went to like just a more relaxed sort of approach, I guess, as opposed to being more formal anyway. So
now that I think about it, there is one thing that we did consciously, and it is something that is said of millennials, it's the experience. And what we, from the beginning, I think, did consciously was always think about the guest experience. What do we want it to be? So it's not just the experience. There's experience in the two meanings. So, you know, how does the guest interact with us from, you know, the, what they call in marketing top of the funnel, blah, 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 how they get here. But also, they want to live an experience. It's not so much about, just to take an example, the quality of the sheet, rather than what are they going to do when they get here? And that is something that instead of millennials, they attach more value to what they're doing and they're living. In other words, their experience rather to the material things that they're getting. And what we emphasize a lot is to help people organize their activities. So we reach out to them. We have some packages that are priced at $0 because all we do is organize, book, you know, their activities, whether it's a hike, fly fishing, some canoeing, whatever they want to do. We partner with people, tours, brewery tours, for example. We partner with people who organize these things, and we're just the middleman, and we don't charge anything. And that's a conscious decision to attract people who, you know, are really looking to live an experience. That was a totally conscious decision. What can we do? And I think in that respect, it is really targeted to millennials, although we didn't exclude any other demographic, but that's something that we educated ourselves about and realized and became, you know, conscious about, that there's a whole segment of the population, which you may want to call millennials, who's really coming to do something fun.
Yeah, actually, now that you mentioned that, we try to make as many suggestions as we can, and then we leave people alone. If
right.
they want more information, they come back. We actually crafted a number of handouts, because
right.
we believe it or not, people still like, you know, handouts, you know, when they get here. For example, you know, there are a few hikes that are very close to our property, and we tell them, well, this is how you get there. This is what you can do in that hike. This is where it takes you. And by the way, here's a map and here's a little bit of history about that particular hike.
Right.
Another example is a foliage drive, which we personally designed. We drove the car. One is more focused on back roads, that foliage drive, and the other one just regular roads. And we said, we drove those, we tested them, we liked them during foliage, if you'd like to try them. And then we handed out.
We also had the whole rainy day.
Yeah, it's a rainy day activity.
You need at least 3 rainy days to get through that whole list of stuff to do.
Right. So that people come here on a weekend and it so happens that, you know, it rains, so they're all disappointed. Well, no, there's a lot to do indoors, actually, as well, too.
Wow, that's fantastic. I mean, you're like preaching to the choir as far as the experience thing, because that's really what the Frictionless Guest app is all about, without getting into that. But I'm just saying, like, wow, that's fantastic. That's cool.
Nice, good stuff. Steve, should we shift and ask them about their perspective on Airbnb and their overall Airbnb strategy?
That sounds good, Matt.
All right, perfect. So Isabel and Kareem, I'll kick that one over to you. Tell us about how you approach Airbnb and what's your strategy for that.
Our strategy, well, first, we're using Airbnb. We have unapologetically put 3 rooms on Airbnb and gotten a few bookings through Airbnb. So we figured, you know, since they're there, we might as well use them as a marketing channel. Not that it, you know, doesn't make a huge difference, but we did get a little traffic from them. And that's also something that we discovered through our search for bed and breakfast, talking to other owners, we had that question, what about Airbnb? And they said, you know, go ahead and use them. They're cheaper than the other OTAs anyway, so might as well, you know, take advantage of it. But our perspective is, I think there's a few things that can be said about Airbnb. First, it started as, you know, what the B&B is. You know, you were supposed to just rent a room. My understanding is that it's how it started. You were renting a room at somebody's house, and you were getting the real local experience, and you were interacting with that person and discovering the whole place. Now it's shifting to something entirely different that poses several problems. It's, you know, you're renting an empty space, you don't ever see the person, you get instructions how to get your key, you go in there, you don't meet any locals, you do your thing, and then you leave. And that poses several problems. One of them, it creates unfair competition with other B&Bs who are subject to taxes, health inspections, safety inspections. Poses the guests at risk because in places where the Airbnbs are not inspected, they are at risk of health and hazards. And they don't interact that much with the community. And also it impacts communities a lot, as you know, in that a lot of people now are investing in properties to turn them into Airbnbs, and it creates whole neighborhoods in highly touristy areas that are, you know, there are no locals who can afford to live there anymore. So we kind of like the stance that Woodstock has taken on that, and they might decide to take it a notch further, we don't know. And the state of Vermont has been very active in creating a level playing field for Airbnb. There's a whole, you know, I'm not the best person to talk about it, but there is a whole tax.
So the taxes are levied directly by Airbnb and paid back to the state.
And in Woodstock, there is a limit as to how many times you can rent your property through short-term rental, really. That's how they're called throughout the year. And
there are challenges, right? I mean, how do you actually monitor this? How do you actually enforce the rules?
Right.
I think that the will is there in order to maintain that residential sort of feel, which is what really attracts people here. You know, it's the quintessential New England village, right? And it's quaint. Mm-hmm. So they would like to protect that image. But there are challenges, you know, as I just said, the monitoring, the enforcement of the rules, et cetera. So those rules actually are up for review and renewal by the board. So the board of the village and the town are working on it right now. And they are looking at what's happening at the state level as well. Yeah. And VIBA, the Vermont in Bed and Breakfast Association, is very much engaged in that as well.
Mm-hmm. Steve, any thoughts, comments, questions?
So you say you put 3 rooms up out of your 9. What's the philosophy there?
We just thought maybe that the entry-level rooms, the lower rooms, because our thinking was probably people who are looking for an Airbnb are looking to save some money. So we just tried it all that. And then what we added now, because we realized, wait, there's maybe a missed opportunity. We also added the whole B&B.
Especially in the winter.
Right. We heard from another B&B actually here. They're a little bit smaller. They have 5 rooms, but they get quite some traffic by renting the whole place, you know, in the winter, but they are on site. It's not, you know, the keys are under the doormat or in a whatever. And we put the whole B&B on Airbnb, but we will provide the same level of service. You know, we'll cook breakfast every morning. We'll clean the rooms. We'll be around. We'll help them, you know, with their dinner reservations. And
so it's Airbnb Plus, if you will.
So I'm sorry, you're saying that during the busy seasons, you just put the three cheapest rooms, less expensive rooms, put them up?
No, what happens is that everything is on it all the time, but the way our system is configured, the minute somebody books one room, whether through Airbnb or directly through us or through an OTA, then the whole house is no longer available, right? Because that one room is already rented.
Which is going to happen often.
Which happens often.
Yeah.
So therefore, the time now when the whole house is still available,
it's going to be during slow.
It's slow season, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Got it.
So a family could go online right now, and they would, like, right now March is not very busy, so they would just be like, hey, you get the cousins together, and we can rent this whole place.
Yeah. I mean, generally speaking, you know, the decision to put the 3 sort of more entry level rooms is also a test as far as we're concerned. And then people who are looking maybe just to book one room, they might be a little bit more conscious about, you know, what they're willing to pay. And even though our fees compared to the OTAs, right, our fees would be lower on Airbnb, the folks that do use Airbnb are subject to fees that are not insignificant. So we got to balance that too.
Mm-hmm.
We're not sure about that. We really have a strategy or anything really thought through Airbnb. We're just giving it a try. We're not sure, you know, maybe we should put all our rooms. We're just trying things out right now.
I was wondering, have you ever run into guests that got there and were kind of confused because they booked on Airbnb and they didn't expect to be staying at an inn? Was anybody ever confused about kind of what they were getting through Airbnb?
No, because we don't leave it mysterious / hazy on the Airbnb site. We very specifically say that this is at the Woodstock or Bed and Breakfast. Mm-hmm. And included in that are the following amenities, et cetera. So we're really using it as a venue to, you know, drive occupancy and sales pretty much.
Right. Okay. But that's the only OTA type service that you're using. Is that right?
No.
We use Expedia, we use booking.com. So we're diversified when it comes to that.
Okay. And what's your percentage of rooms booked through those, you know, that aren't direct?
Right now, I would say that I would want to guess maybe 10 to 15% at this stage that is not direct.
Okay.
We also have relationships with a couple of travel agencies that also bring us another maybe 10%.
Yeah.
So if you consider those not direct booking through our site, then, you know, if you add up all those percentages, anywhere in the 20% would not come directly from people hitting our website and booking directly through it.
Okay. So you're saying that the majority of your bookings are direct bookings?
Yes.
Okay. Right. Okay. Yeah, because I would think that you're, like you say, you've got repeat guests who are repeating stays that have been there before, maybe prior to you all owning the B&B, and then you want to continue to build on that so you're not having to pay the OTA charges, preferably, right? So I would assume that you're trying to, I guess, if you have someone from Airbnb or Expedia or whatever, I guess you try to get them to book directly once they've stayed with you. Is that kind of the approach?
We do inform them that they're paying more, you know, that surcharge on Airbnb. And also, you know, they don't get our deals. The communication is not as easy. They get the reminders or it's
no.
It's the whole communication point that's sort of tricky.
Yeah, it's not under our
control.
Right. So if we have a special, it's hard to communicate with those folks. But some guests have told us, yes, they know that they're paying surcharge because they compared the prices. But there's other incentives for them, right? You know, they may be getting, you know, points or awards or whatever those sites actually offer them.
Right. Yeah. Makes sense. Okay. Good.
Awesome. All right. Good. Should we wrap it up with our what does the future hold question or any other topics we'd like to explore today on this podcast?
Yeah. We can talk a little bit about the future, which obviously we hope is going to be bright. You know, we've been in business officially only since mid-May and June. It's been extremely exciting. We've met so many wonderful people. We're on a huge learning curve.
Yeah.
It's really exciting for us. It's very tiring. So anybody who out there thinks that this is, you know, semi-retirement or retirement, it's not. You know, owning, especially in sort of active towns such as Woodstock, et cetera, you're really running a business. And, you know, it's a lifestyle that you also choose. You know, you are at the service of your guests, you know, no matter what time of day or night, frankly. And our focus right now, I think, is about, wouldn't you agree, is really to keep looking on how we can improve, even if it's marginally on certain things. And
we're
being
still
very responsive to the feedback we get from our guests.
I think we're still in startup mode because right now we're looking back at all the things that we didn't do, we should have done. So we're fixing those, whether it's in our marketing, on our website, in our processes here. I think the future is, you know, never stop improving. I think that's kind of true in any aspect of business, but I don't know what the future holds.
Yeah, I mean, there's danger in just settling in and thinking this is business as usual and that's how it's going to be, because it is an industry that is really evolving, which makes it exciting, frankly, from an intellectual point of view. And where we're also continuing to see how we can increase partnerships with local, let's call them vendors, right? I mean, people that offer experiences, or people that, you know, own businesses in town, be it restaurants or art galleries,
right,
et cetera. So that is going to be a continued effort for us mm-hmm. because, you know, frankly, we're new here.
Yep.
And even though we have forged a lot of relationships and people are so welcome here, that is going to continue, at least for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, it's just the beginning for us. So we're working on increasing our midweek occupancy. And yeah, and we still have to go through our whole first winter. So
yeah, and we love to see. So whenever yeah. we have a moment,
yeah.
you know, we go put in a couple of hours and come back.
That's great. Wonderful.
So is it fair to say that, I mean, you don't have a timeline. Obviously, no one can do anything for forever. But is it fair to say that you really don't kind of have a timeline? You just want to see how far this goes and enjoy the day to day until you get to the point where you say, I don't want to do it anymore? Is that kind of your approach?
Yeah, I think yeah, so.
Yeah. yeah. I mean, you know, we're also not at an age where we can hop from one opportunity to the next like that. I mean, we had fulfilling careers, as we said, and
yeah.
this is something, the first time we own our own business, right?
Right.
So for us, it's really exciting. It's a little bit scary, yes, of course, but it's also very, very much exciting. And as you just said it, we're going to see where this takes us and,
yeah.
and the future will dictate what the next step is.
Yep, I can relate. So that's cool. Yep.
Awesome. Well, perfect. I think that's a great way to end this podcast. And for all of our listeners, you just heard an exclusive Frictionless Innkeeper podcast interview where Isabel Chicoin and Karim Houri, who are the owners of the Woodstocker B&B in Woodstock, Vermont, shared their overall innkeeper story, their Airbnb strategy, and what the future holds for them as innkeepers. And we really hope you enjoyed this episode of the Frictionless Innkeeper podcast, brought to you by the Frictionless Guest app. And if you wish to learn more, please visit frictionlessguest.com. Once again, that's frictionlessguest.com.